You're listening to the Fit Talk Show, produced by Channel Radio. It's the Food Talk Show with me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Brady Last. Hello, Brady. How are you?
Hello. How are you, Paul?
I'm really well, thanks. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me today. I'm so excited.
It is. Now, we've just told two of the biggest porkers ever, haven't we? Because you said, how are you? And I said, I'm really well. And I said, how are you? And you said, I'm really well. And before we went live on air, we both went, do you know what? Don't feel very well.
No. Not very poorly. A bit poorly today, but yeah. We've got our... You know, we're heading in the right place for this because we've got an exciting show today.
So. We have. We've got loads of interesting guests to talk to, and there's beer and everything here, which will normally sort out most things, won't it?
Absolutely.
But it's good. But I tell you what, the offices are a bit empty today as well, though, Brady.
It is. It's probably the busiest day in the Food Talk Show history, I would say. Everyone is mostly in London today.
What is it about this week?
Well, it's the Food Tech Week, London Food Tech Week. So what's happening today is everybody's at this amazing venue in London, the hottest food venue in town.
When you say everyone apart from you and me and Tim here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just... We're holding the fort, but we're doing a good job.
No, we're doing the work, aren't we?
We're doing the work. Grafting.
But it's been such a busy week, hasn't it? It's really been busy, and I haven't been involved really with Food Tech Week. I've just been doing other stuff. I've been chairing a digital event this morning. It's just manic at the moment.
It is. It's such a busy time of year. I just think it's everything's trying to be squashed in, isn't it, before Christmas, before things get
too
busy.
Don't say the C word.
I know.
Don't say the C word.
I've got children, Paul. They're talking about it already. Can't get away from it. Yeah. It's everywhere.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to my aged parents last night, and I said, what do you want to do for Christmas dinner? And they went, can we eat out? Because, you know, my cooking goes down.
Perfect. Yeah. That sounds like a dream.
And they said, can we eat out where we ate out last year? And I went, yeah, of course we can. And then my mum said, but I think it'll be fully booked by now. I go, no, it won't. There's ages to go yet.
I think, the signs have been up outside eateries for, you know, a good 8 weeks. People book a year in advance.
They do. To be fair, I have actually done that myself in previous years when I wanted to go somewhere incredibly special and just thought, I'm not taking a chance on this. I'm having that.
Well, maybe one of our guests could help you later because they make these exceptional sort of eating at home meals. We're not going to call them ready meals, but they make these amazing meals for you to eat at home. They're restaurant quality. So
that could be interesting. Mm. I don't mind cooking. I've always cooked Christmas dinner for my lot because they're useless at cooking. And sorry, Mum. And I don't mind doing that. I tell you what I dislike, though. It's the shopping beforehand. Yeah. It's having to get it all in. Mm. And my lot, I the last time I cooked, which was about 3 years ago, I had 15 people for Christmas lunch. And all 15 of them had different eating needs.
Dietary requirements.
Yeah, that's the chap. Vegetarian, a vegan, a gluten intolerant, my dad's going, I'm not eating turkey. Why? Have you not heard about that Asian bird flu? And I go, oh, please.
Can't you get the kebab house to deliver on Christmas Day?
Is Zaffa and the kebab shop game, I'd be sorted for Christmas, mate. I'd have extra chilli sauce. I'd have Doner kebab, extra chilli sauce. with a cracker. That's what I'd have. Anyway,
back to where everyone is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Food Talk Show Unboxed today. Mm. Big event. We talked about it last week. Mm. So everybody's there. It's absolutely fantastic event. It's already started. So once this show's finished, if you have a look at the Facebook page, Food Talk Show Facebook page, there's some live video streaming on there. So...
Of the unboxing.
Yeah.
As it happens, yeah. Wow. It's exciting, isn't it?
Have a look. It's exciting. Look at the website and everything else.
Funnily enough, we were talking about this at the digital conference today. A lot of the stuff we were talking about was about YouTube videos and Facebook Live and things like that and the whole phenomena of unboxing and just how awesome a lot of video stuff is. Mm. And we were talking to a chap called Dan Knowlton who specialises in that, and he was telling us that on average, a decent 30-second video clip can eventually generate like 5 million views on Facebook. It's just, and some of it's the most horrendous rubbish. You know, you just think, really? Would anybody want to watch that? But they do.
Yeah, and I sit over my daughter's shoulder sometimes and think, what are you watching? Yeah, yes, so absolutely. You have to monitor these things.
So we've got loads of guests today, haven't we? And we've got Tim in the studio, who we're going to be talking to later.
Yep.
Hello.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Very
how are
well, you? Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for coming.
It's good to see you. We've also got...
we've got Natalia and Jonathan Conroy from Kitchen Orchard, who the couple was talking about earlier.
Yep.
They make these amazing meals that you cook at home and all you need is a saucepan.
And we're going to talk to them on the phone, aren't we?
Yes, on the phone, yep.
But before all of that, we've got a little bit of a pre-record, haven't
we? Yes, we have. So coming up now, it's an interview with Sue Nelson and Lucy and Harry from the Food Talk Show. They're going to be talking a little bit about their experiences this week at the Food Tech Week, an event they've been to and things. So,
okay, let's have a listen to this.
Hi there. So I'm with Lucy Ellis, who's a producer on the Food Talk Show, and I'm also with Harry, who's our researcher. And we'd like to talk a little bit about the London Food Tech Week, which is very, very exciting. It's huge. It's absolutely massive. There's dozens and dozens and dozens of events all across London in different places. And we're holding, as the Food Talk Show, an incredible unboxing event. And I'm just going to pass you over to Lucy, who's going to explain to you what unboxing is. Need to know, because I know it's a bit of an internet YouTube sensation. So what is unboxing?
Well, unboxing, it's we actually found out about it through our children, because it's a real big internet thing all over YouTube. And it started off with my son actually watching Kinder Eggs being opened.
Kinder Eggs, as in the chocolatey Kinder Eggs with the little toy things inside.
Yeah, so you just see these big hands unwrapping a Kinder Egg wrapper, and there'll be loads of anticipation on what the actual toy is going to be. So it's moved on quite a bit since then.
So presumably it's live then? They're actually watching something that's happening right that minute somewhere?
Yes, they are. A lot of it is then sort of watched again, especially on YouTube. And just recently, last sort of year or so, it's got a really big thing, especially with grown-ups. So people are unboxing things like the new iPhone 7, new PlayStations, and they even unbox things with games, basically. So you'll be watching someone play a PlayStation 3 game, for instance.
So that's quite useful if you've got something like the iPhone 7, because you're not sure whether to buy it. You read all these reviews, obviously. But the thing with unboxing is it means that you can actually see... not only see the product, but actually see how somebody approaches the product. So they get hold of it. They don't know how this works, or they switch that on. Because let's face it, nobody reads the instructions, do they?
No, exactly. I, for one, they go straight in the bin. It's a really good tool for basically just watching someone. I mean, loads of people, when I speak to people about unboxing now, loads of people don't actually realise that they're watching unboxing videos. Because, for instance, if... I did it when I was trying to rewire my lawnmower, which is a long story. But I then started YouTubing sort of how to fix a lawnmower and things like that. And it came up with all sorts of different unboxing videos on lawnmowers and really how to work them and how to fix them and so on. So many people are watching them, but just don't know.
Well, that's the biggest search term, isn't it, on YouTube, is how to. Yeah. It's the biggest search term. I think also for me as a marketing person, unboxing is really, really useful because you're getting real, true, honest user experience feedback, aren't you? And when you get in love with your product, you assume everybody knows how to use it. You assume they know which button to switch. You assume that they assiduously read all the instructions from page 1 to page 50, but of course they don't. So it's great for feedback.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's a really good sort of tool, especially like you were saying, like for someone that's got a new product in the market, for people to then sort of come across it. They might have searched something else on YouTube or Twitter or something like that, but they then come across your product and they can really, it's not just seeing it in its packaging sat on the shelf or in your internet basket. You can really sort of see exactly what it does.
And somebody going, okay, well, that wire goes here. Oh, no, it doesn't. It goes in there, and you know, you can see all that live. So for London Food Tech Week, the Food Talk Show is doing two unboxing events. We've got a panel, I think, of experts. We've got some television cameras there. We're going to do some radio from there. So what have you got lined up for the event? And it's on the day of this programme, actually. It's on Thursday the 20th at 5:30. What have you got lined up?
I'm not sure I'm allowed to say anything because it's all hush-hush
I guess that's the point of unboxing. Okay. So tell me who you've got on the panel. You've got bloggers and people like that, haven't you, really, who've got a really good social media presence?
Yeah, so we've got some really, really good people. We've got a mum who does like a real sort of like good parent and lifestyle blog. We've got Tessa. Tessa Stewart, she basically specialises in packaging in the food industry. So I think she's a real sort of key. We've got a chef. We've got all sorts. We have got a couple of bloggers, actually, but it's going to be such a good event.
So it's just like any member of the public who get faced, you know, with all that sort of stuff, really. Okay, that's great. So you're going to have this event, and it's at the new Mercato Metropolitano. It's one of my new favourite places in London. Do you just want to describe what it's like? And it's just along from Borough Market.
Food heaven. In one.
Food heaven, okay. And full of Italian people who really love their food and know about food.
Exactly, what more would you want? It's a massive space. There's a lovely Italian supermarket there, which I think I probably spent the best part of an hour in. I'm not sure if that's normal behaviour, just because I love my food. Loads of absolutely gorgeous little restaurants that you can go to. There's a massive selection there. It's going to be brilliant, best venue I can think of for the actual event. So,
and there's people like selling amazing mozzarella, people selling, there's a proper huge pizza oven, wood oven, and there's there's charcuterie, there's cheese, there's a brilliant baker. Actually, I took some bread home just to let you know, Lucy. So it's a really great venue, isn't it? And if you've got a family and they all want to eat something different, you've got such a wide choice.
Exactly. I tried mozzarella there on their VIP launch night. It was a brilliant night. And the mozzarella, I've never had anything as delicious. I always found that mozzarella was quite a bland cheese that you just chucked on some pizza or in some pasta or something like that. But after having that, it was so creamy. I now have to go to Waitrose, especially. Yeah, because I only do two types in my local Sainsbury's anyway. So
you've been a mozzarella convert. Now, I know that you've been invited to quite a few of the other, sort of venues and events at the London Food Tech Week, which finishes this weekend. I know that you got invited to a VIP insect bar with Harry here. So I'm going to ask Harry, what on earth is a VIP insect bar? And you turned up. Did you know what to expect?
No, absolutely had no idea what to expect. We turned up to Carousel London, just a restaurant just off Baker Street, and we were sort of waiting outside for a bit, and then sort of down into the bottom of the basement, all dark, and sort of had an insect smell to it as well.
Describe to me what an insect smell is then.
I guess I can only imagine being in the middle of a forest with insects being the only
smell.
Yeah, it was certainly quite a fragrant smell. Yeah, it was, as soon as we got back out into the fresh air, I was like, relieved to be out.
So you go downstairs, it's all dark, slightly odd smell. What is this VIP insect bar opening then?
So it was a list of all different stands that had all different insects and insects ingredients. So the first thing that we saw was a chocolate brownie. So I was thinking,
that's nice.
You know, that's going to be, you know, lovely chocolate brownie. And then you notice that it's made with cricket flour.
But still tastes good?
Yeah, it still tasted good. So, I mean, a lot of the things just tasted exactly like it would normally, but it's got a lot of health benefits compared to sort of the usual ingredients that you'd use.
And insects packed full of protein, of course.
Yeah, I think they were saying in the presentation at the end there was 70% more protein in insect powder as opposed to what they'd usually use to make products such as the ice lollies that were there as well.
And also, obviously, environmentally much more sound to be using sort of insect-based products than you know, meat products.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was sort of part of the reason why I was there, just the whole sustainability thing. And yeah, I think it's definitely something for the future. So we go through.
More
and,
how we're going to feed everybody on the planet, or it's going to be insects.
Exactly.
Right, so just run me through just a couple of the products there. And I know you made a bit of a mistake, didn't you, while you were there?
I did make a faux pas, yes. So at one end there was smoked crickets, all different flavour of smoked crickets. And on one particular table they had, I think it was mealworms or maggots. they were on the same table.
Were they moving?
The plate was moving, and I thought, well, here's my I'm a Celebrity moment. So I picked up a couple of the grubs or
whatever they are,
maggots, mealworms. I don't know what they were.
Mealworms.
They weren't labelled, so it was going into the dark. And picked up a handful, put them straight in my mouth, and
just to check here, they were alive.
They were alive. Yeah, they were moving.
So you ate them?
Of course.
What did they taste like?
No. Do you know what? They tasted like, I got laughed for saying that in the office when I told people, but it sort of had like a bolognese flavour to it.
Right.
It was definitely meaty.
Right.
I actually preferred the live maggots to the smoked ones.
Right.
But it was only after I'd eaten them that someone from the event came over and said, oh, they're actually just for show, those. You're not really supposed to eat them. So,
you did say it was fine, though, didn't
yeah,
you?
Oh, yeah, they're perfectly edible. And
so you haven't, you're okay?
Oh, yeah.
You survived?
Well, yeah, I'm all right today, so I think I survived that one, but right. I maybe wouldn't try it again.
And the feeling amongst the people at the event is that this is, literally, this is the future. We've got to find ways of using this material because there is going to be a food problem, isn't there, feeding people, and we can't keep eating loads and loads of cows and sheep and, you know, huge big sort of meat products.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And they were saying about the difference between like beef burgers and sort of that they were making patties out of crickets, and it was the health benefits are there as well. And obviously then you've not got the effects on the environment. Absolutely, the insects might not say the same thing, but
And the taste for you?
Most of the products that were, so we say, normal products, like the brownies, there was pasta, so cricket pasta, wasn't it? Yeah. It just tasted exactly like normal food. So at one of the stands, the cricket pasta, they came around and said, well, what does it taste like? It's just pasta.
Yeah,
it's
pasta.
It tastes no difference. But yeah. If you eat a bowl of that compared to a bowl that you'd buy from any supermarket, then you're going to have an extra sort of kick for the rest of the day, extra energy. So it's only a positive thing.
Good. Okay, well, I'm glad I didn't get invited to the VIP insect bar. Obviously not important enough. So just to check out, please look on social media on Thursday the 20th for the unboxing event by this lovely radio show, the Food Talk radio show. And there's going to be loads of stuff on there. And look at some of the products we're unboxing. There's a really interesting mix. I can't say at the moment what they are, but just go onto social media and have a look, or go onto our website. And of course, it's London Food Tech Week. There's still events going on up to the weekend. And we're also quite involved with Tech London Advocates, who are also sponsoring it. And that's a great organisation. So check those out too. So have a good day. And I'll leave the next VIP insect to you, Harry, because obviously you like the old live insects. So there we go.
Got a taste of it now. So.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
Oh, live insects, huh? Not nice.
No.
Not nice at all. Now, I'm hoping that we've got on the phone now Jonathan Natalia from Kitchen Orchard.
So,
are you there? Hi.
Hi there.
Oh, perfect.
Hello.
We can hear you perfectly. That's fabulous news. Well done. thank you so much for joining us on the Food Talk Show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
And I'm not sure whereabouts you are, but here down in Kent, where the studio is, it's pouring a rain here, and it's not particularly nice Thursday afternoon. So I hope it's better where you are.
No, it's fine. We're West London, so it was raining about an hour ago, but we're all clear now.
Oh, okay.
All right, West London, my home, my home. Okay.
Lovely.
So, guys, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and what you do?
Long story short, Natalia and I, we met cooking at the River Cafe. We're both chefs. I was there for about 8 years, and Natalia was there for sort of 2 or 3 years. During that time we met, we married. After that we wanted to carry on cooking, but we also wanted to use our skills, not necessarily in a direct restaurant environment.
Right, okay.
And over the course of 2 years we have developed what we are Kitchen Orchard.
Right, okay.
I love the name, Kitchen Orchard.
Thank you. It was a funny roundabout way of getting there. I wrote a book, The Kitchen Orchard, which was published by Ebury Press a couple of years ago. And
it's on my Christmas list, Natalia.
Oh,
it looks so lovely.
We'll pop a copy in the post. But we were trying to do a product with a different name, and then we got back to the inevitable, which was, of course, we would try to add to the brand and use the recipes. So actually, one of our dishes that we were cooking today, the beef with porcini and Chianti, that recipe is in the book. So developing recipes based on our experience in restaurants and also the odd one from the book. We're also writing a second book at the moment.
Cool. We should tell our listeners that you guys are talking to us on a loudspeakerphone, and it's because it's kind of fading in about in and out now and again.
Okay, we'll try and talk a bit closer then.
Yeah, yeah. If you could both sit on top of it, that would do it. I think that would do it.
That's what me and Paul do in the studio.
Yeah, yeah. We've only got one microphone and everything here. Tell us about Kitchen Orchard. Tell us how you've gone about looking at what you do and what the kind of USP, if you like, of what you do is.
Well, we were private chefing after the River Cafe, and we had a number of clients in the sort of London area. Mm. More and more, they were asking us to be in their house less and less. I don't know, maybe there was something wrong with us, but ultimately they wanted the food delivered. Ready to go. Mm. And as this developed, we found ourselves delivering it in all sorts of Tupperware and pots and takeaway things. And we realized that we had to develop something that was a lot cleaner and a lot better looking. Mm. And what we've done is we've just developed over the last 2 years a range of 7 dishes that brings all our experience together. It is basically restaurant-grade, high-end food that we've cooked and then packaged. And that's being sold in shops across London.
Oh, okay.
What we hope to be a sort of unique selling point is that the suppliers that we've used over the years, whether it was down at Rick Stein's or Peacham Nurseries or the River Cafe, we are putting Chianti wine that was being used in the restaurants into our dishes. We're using the same suppliers, and we're trying to transpose recipes that would be on a restaurant plate, but into that sort of delivery meal that you're going to get. It's free range. There are no preservatives, and it's a sort of clean deck restaurant food if you want. And we've been very conscious not to throw butter into things that don't need to be in things, and trying to kind of pare things back to their tastiest without being too over the top.
What I think is really clever, and I was looking on the website, is the packaging that you've used is quite different to what would be your typical ready meal. So if you've got the clear packaging, it's kind of, it's like a sachet, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a large sort of clear plastic pouch. We figured that our food looks great and we wanted to show it off, and we didn't want to hide it behind sort of cardboard packaging with a picture of our food.
Sure. And the colours and everything, because what's green is green, what should be green is green, for example.
I think the other key thing is that we really wanted something that was sort of clean and no fuss, and you can throw it in the freezer and it will come out as, it's not going to have brittle plastic, it's going to be kept safe, and all our food is fresh, so pop it in the freezer. Even the card on top with all the details, that comes out of the freezer looking fresh and clean. So we've really tried to go for a premium package to represent what's inside, hopefully.
It definitely looks that way.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by this. We've had many discussions on the Food Talk show about the changing, landscape in food, and especially in big urban areas, London and Manchester and all of our other cities. Lots of people are moving away into takeout food and just delivered food and things like that. And we've been talking about that quite a lot, because it strikes us that there's all kinds of connotations happening there, not least of which, especially in places like London and West London, where space is at a premium, that, it's not going to be long before people start doing away with the kitchen and turning it into another bedroom and just ordering food online or whatever.
I mean, if you look at New York is already building apartments with no kitchens.
Right.
They're much further ahead in this whole delivery food system. They've been at it for decades almost, and they really are pushing the boundaries on it. But London is moving towards that. People are busier, people are working more. It's expensive to eat in a restaurant these days, it's a tough one. So I think with the likes of Deliveroo and Hubbub, which our food sort of is getting used on by the shops that we deliver to, it's the versatility that's really winning people over. That people are working later, people are working harder,
right.
And they want to eat healthily, they want to eat good food. They don't want to eat local sort of takeaway meal that slops around in a tinfoil container delivered on the bed of a motorbike. It's
a bit more of a refined experience. And
absolutely. You know, we always thought about, you get home, you've got a restaurant reservation, or you want to go out with the missus, and you know what, you're exhausted, but you don't want to eat, you don't want to eat toast, and you don't want to eat rubbish, and that's where we come in. It's a beautifully cooked, well thought, well planned, executed dish by two Michelin star River Cafe chefs.
Right.
And it's great. It's in your home. You get to cook the sides. You get to eat at your dinner table on your time frame. You don't get the bad table down the back near the toilets. You don't have to pay 25 quid for a taxi. You know, it's on your terms. And I think people are looking for something a bit more refined and interesting for when they do stay in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry, Paul. So excited about this because I've got two children, and you know, sometimes I don't mind giving the kids a pizza, but I don't really want a pizza. this is why I'm really excited about it. And what you were saying about versatility, for me, I think the fact that you've got these kind of this is part of the core part of would be the core part of my dinner. I can add to it. I can still have some fresh spinach or some nice bread or something. So you can make it your own.
It's great that you feel like that, because you know, some people have said to us, yeah, but I still have to do a side dish, I still have to do a bit. But we're not trying to answer all the questions. We're trying to say, here is a main course, let's take care of the 4-hour slow cooked pork.
Right.
Depending on your taste, maybe you just want some crusty bread with some butter with it, or maybe you're going light and you want some salad. So it is an opportunity for you to kind of tailor it to what suits your family. And in terms of portion sizes, you know, one packet for us, 200 grams of meat per person with, you know, two vegetable sides is normally how we would eat. So it's more than enough for two people.
Right. And not disparaging myself too much, I'm sure that I'd actually claim total responsibility for the whole meal occasionally with the right person dining with me.
Yeah.
Well, we've always tried to stay away from telling people how much to eat, but we always say if you've got, you know, hungry teenagers or a guest with an unknown appetite, you know, get a couple more in, because it freezes. Everything that we use actually goes straight in the freezer. There's never a bit of wastage. So
and just say you made it. You know, it's yours to do what you want with it.
Oh, I would definitely.
Oh, so, me too. Yeah, I just knocked this up. Like, you know, I had 5 minutes spare. Yeah. So just talk me through the process. What happens? There's a menu, obviously, and I look at the menu. I decide what I want, a meal for two, and I order it from you. What happens from there?
So we are selling through stores only. So what you would do is you'd pop down. At the moment, we're selling through. So we've got H.G. Walter, our butcher in Barons Court. And they are also on Hubbub. So you could either pop down to the store, they also do delivery, or you could look at it through Hubbub. We're in Jeroboam's in Holland Park and Mr. Christian's in Notting Hill Gate. We're also in talks with Melrose and Morgan, who are up in Hampstead and Primrose Hill.
Right.
So basically, you would need to pop down there and have a look.
Okay.
And see what you fancy, really.
Okay, so I popped down to the Greater Shepherd's Bush area, and I go into a store, and I can, that looks lovely. I'm going to have that. So I buy some food to take home. How do I prepare it? What's the normal way of doing this?
Just simply pop it into a saucepan and give it 5 minutes on a medium gas heat. You know, it's a real old fashioned traditional. You know, I mean, people have asked, can you microwave it? And of course,
no, don't microwave it. You shout at them.
You know, on the back of the packet, we give instructions to heat for 5 minutes gently on a medium heat and make sure it's piping hot. And it's as simple as that, really. You know, it's
sure.
It's very old fashioned in that, you know, there's no trickery involved. It's honest, simple food. You know, and we wanted to supply our favourite delis in London, you know, small independent places that know a good bit of food when they see it, you know, and we're very lucky to have our suppliers who we have, because, you know, although we've worked in great restaurants, we're still new, we're still young, and you know, it's great to have that opportunity to be able to sell to the public.
Absolutely. And I just want to dwell on that for a moment, Jonathan, if I may.
Yeah.
I like to look at these things from a business point of view as well as from a gourmet point of view. So for you guys, where are you in the journey with your business?
In the eye of the storm. we're pretty much day three of delivering to stores. We're in our first week, which we've had great results. All the first orders went out on Tuesday. They've reordered again today for the weekend, which is just, you know...
Dream come true.
It's really, really fantastic. These things do take time, and, you know, in a restaurant world, you're looking at 2 to 3 years before you see any kind of financial return, you know, and that's that is business in food and restaurants. And we're hoping to be able to produce these great dishes with a small team helping us and just keep on doing it, really. It's a real nice, slow-burning business that we want to keep sort of family-orientated, you know. It's about the food. There's no other kind of sort of hidden message behind it. You know, it's as simple as that.
I know it might be early days and you may not, you know, fully decided yet, looking at the ins and outs of this, but have you any thoughts on upscaling it? I mean, presumably your sales are in London at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's definitely at the forefront of our minds. And in terms of, you know, our food could definitely travel, so we could be looking at, you know, a couple of hours either way from London and try and get, you know, into delis and stores and try and sort of hook up with communities that aren't just in London. But in terms of upscaling it, we need, you know, we're committed to keeping it handmade. Handmade is really at the core of it. And, you know, we at the moment are doing all the cooking and we will always be cooking. We hope to have a team that we can slowly train and, you know, really, really keep a good handle on it, keeping it seasonal and ultimately keeping it as small as is possible whilst it being financially viable.
Sure.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, obviously, we're in Kent, so I'm hoping it might travel a
little
bit.
We're not far away.
Southeast. Yeah. But, you know, I'm sure it's going to continue to be extremely successful.
Very exciting, and it is early days, you know. Could we open a kitchen where we train other people in another part of England? You know, lots of things, really. You can never rule them out. We'd love to move. But I think for us, we're so sort of determined to keep the food what it is, and obviously it has to be that way.
Yeah.
With and how do you grow that? That's one of the big questions, isn't it? About a business.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How do you move?
Yeah. It's always a really difficult thing in the food production business.
Of course it is. I mean, how do you keep your quality? Because every restaurant starts with these great ideas of let's keep the wine costs down, let's make the dishes really accessible but really punchy, and it's a very hard financial balancing act. And
absolutely,
I hope what we've done is that by not renting a London restaurant premises, the costs have been kept down and the ingredients. You know, there is 112 mil of Chianti in every one of the beef and Chianti recipes. It's exact science. You know, we are cooking very exactly each. Very precise, but what it is, we're able to scale up, and also that allows us to put really great ingredients in.
Absolutely. Listen, guys, we wish you all power to your operation.
Thank you so much.
It sounds wonderful. I want to take.
And when we're in Kent, you'll be first on the list.
Oh no, I'm coming home. I'm originally from Shepherd's Bush. I'm coming home to. I'm round Holland Park any time now for some of that. Don't you worry.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Just before you go, guys, give us a shout out for websites, Facebook pages, Twitter handles, any way that people can find out more about you.
Hello,
can you hear me?
Oh yeah, so we're on Instagram, we're at Kitchen Orchard, and we're www.kitchenorchard.com.
fantastic. www.kitchenorchard.com or Instagram. Do give these guys a follow. They're doing some fabulous stuff, and the food looks wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you
so much for joining us on the Food Talk Show. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Cheers now. Bye-bye. What an interesting concept.
Yeah, it really is. It's something which I would definitely have in my fridge, and it looks nice as well.
Yeah. It's one of those interesting things, isn't it? Good quality food, you don't need to eat vast amounts of either.
That's true. And I think with what they're doing, it's quite clever how they've said to people, you can eat the whole thing if you want, but actually have half and add some vegetables. So kind of the guilt of buying something that's ready made is taken away a bit, because you feel like, oh, you know, you can prepare something fresh to go with it. Yeah. It's really good. It's a really good idea.
Yeah, well, when you're a blagger like me, you got to do a little bit. You go, no, look, I did it all myself. You can still see the potato peelings.
Yeah, and the fact you've got to put it in a saucepan as well. I really like that, rather than just stick it in the microwave.
Yeah, I don't think that would go. I'm sure some people probably do microwave it. And but that's not the way to do it, really, is it? It's a quality product, and that's really what it's about. Yeah,
they've obviously spent a lot of time getting it right, so ruin it and nuke it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, it's fantastic. And as we were saying to the guys there as well, this whole new ethos and new way of doing food is, we've talked about it quite a few times, and it's interesting, Jonathan's saying there that in New York they're already building apartments without kitchens.
I mean that just seems incredible to me. I guess they have some sort of hot plate or something, maybe not
microwave, toaster.
The other thing with their products, which I don't think they mentioned, is they're all free range and gluten and dairy free. And of course, that's something we see all the time on this show.
Sure.
Always talking about how to, you know, the free from market, you know, for people with allergies and intolerances, or just choosing that dietary style.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Some really interesting, innovative stuff starting to happen in the food marketplace Indeed. In the old United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Should we talk to our next guest?
Yes.
Should we do that?
Yes, please.
He's been sitting there patiently waiting for us to finish this nonsense that we come out with sometimes.
Very excited about this. Tim, hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming down.
Not a problem at all.
Where should we begin? I think we should just talk. So Tim's from the Whitstable Brewery.
Yeah. I want to discuss that.
Yeah, that's
because
the first
there's a little bit of stuff going on there. Because, you know, one assumed that the Whitstable Brewery was in Whitstable. But Tim was telling us a little bit of a story about that, and I thought that was interesting.
Mm. One would assume that, and we are the official beer of the Whitstable Oyster Company, so all their venues have our beer on. Our oyster stout was brewed as an accompaniment to their oysters.
Yeah.
And it was originally going to be there right on the harbour. But simply what happened was the money was ready and we were getting the permissions from the council, planning permission, all this sort of thing. And another brewery in Kent, the Swale Brew, which some people may remember, they went bankrupt. And so we were able to buy a ready-made brewery that was more or less ready to start brewing the next week, that was twice as big for the same money as starting from scratch.
And why not?
Perfect.
So we've been there since 2003, and we have recently doubled the size of the brewing capacity. Mm. But looking at what space is left to put new tanks, this sort of thing, into it, there is a limited amount of expansion space. Mm. So the plan in the next couple of years is to build a secondary brewery in Whitstable, which will take up some of the slack. But more importantly, it'll be a lot more accessible. Obviously, we're quite rural, so that'll be in the middle of town. And we're hoping to, you know, add a kind of a visitor element to it.
So it's going to be like a tourist attraction as well as a brewery.
Exactly. You'll be able to see it being done. Yeah. They hopefully will be able to set it up such that you can drink the beer straight out of the brewery tanks.
Very important.
Just
lay on the floor and open a tap.
Yeah. People are seeing this sort of tank beer concept, and I think I'm not so impressed with the idea when it's being delivered to a pub that's X number of miles away, but to have it fresh from the brewery, you know, that's something we'd like to explore. And you know, maybe a limited amount of kind of even involvement in brewing the beer. Obviously, a lot of it is very, very technical, but there are certain elements where, you know, people can get their sort of their hands in. And when as far as we can do that without compromising the beer, obviously we want to get people involved. But absolutely, that's sort of in the medium term for us.
Okay.
I'm there, Tim. I'm there. That's brilliant.
I'd like to explore, if I may, a bit more of the history of the Whitstable Brewery. We've talked about premises, but what was the inspiration? Who started it? In 2003?
Yeah, 2003. Well, what it was the owners of the Whitstable Oyster Company obviously had all these restaurants that were serving beer, and they could see a lot of microbreweries, you know, even back then there were still quite a few that were starting up because the kind of the big defining movement was the introduction of brewer's relief. So breweries below a certain size get half off their alcohol duty as a way to encourage diversity in the industry. And that, although there were microbreweries before that, that really kind of gave a massive impetus, and lots started up. So the owners could see this was happening. And you know, they had, there were other people in Kent they could buy from, but they thought, well, why don't we have our own? We've got enough venues to generate enough supply to make it worthwhile brewing. And so they started off, they bought this brewery. Rafiq Abidi, our head brewer, came in, and originally he was doing everything. He brewed the beer, he did the sales, he drove the van, he did, you know, designed the bottle labels, he wrote the pump clips, absolutely everything. Mm. So it started with that, with one beer, and just for the Oyster Company.
And what was your first beer?
It was our East India Pale Ale, which is our bestseller, and has been, well, by definition, since the beginning.
Right.
That was the start. And then very quickly, we added in the first lager, a more traditional bitter, and the range has sort of grown and grown from there. So at the moment, we're doing 7 permanent ales and 5 craft keg beers. And then usually we try and keep at least one special on, either a special that we want to do because it's interesting, or a seasonal for the time of the year, like a Christmas beer or a green hop beer or something like that.
Okay. So so you got bottled beer, you got kegged beer, you got lager.
Yeah.
And you've got special beer. Can you give us a feeling for some of the special beers you've produced?
Well, I mean, for example, one of my personal favourite special we do are the green hop beers. Now, we used to do one. This year, we managed to do 2. But essentially, it's a really exciting thing that you can only do in a hop-growing area. So Kent, Herefordshire, Worcestershire, and to an extent, Surrey, because they've just started growing hops there again. But what you do is, normally, you would take the hops from the field and they go to a oast house or the modern equivalent, and they get dried. Because hops, they go off very, very quickly. We're talking 12 hours. Mm. So the idea of drying it is it preserves them. However, all the heat drives off a lot of the essential oils, which give the beer the flavour.
Right.
Because what makes a hop useful for brewing beer, it has acids called alpha acids. That what gives beer bitterness and preserves it, and the oils, which are what gives it the flavor. So by preserving the acids and some of the oils, you do lose a significant percentage. So for the last couple of years, what Kentish brewers have been doing is you go straight to the hop farm, you get the hops straight out of the field. They're all wet and spongy, and the smell is absolutely incredible.
He's selling it to me, and I don't even drink.
I mean, this was...
I love your enthusiasm.
I drive a bit of an old heap, but one year the van had broken down. So I took the seats out of my car, I went down there, and I got an enormous Juicin's bag of hops in the back of my car. Mm. And it smelled just wonderful for weeks. But you get that back there, and you brew as soon as you possibly can to keep the hops at their freshest. And what it allows you to do is take a traditional Kentish hop. This year we used East Kent Goldings, which is sort of the most celebrated and the most famous.
Sorry to interrupt you, Tim. Do you always use Kent hops?
We use almost all of our beers, unless it's specifically a single hop ale, are blends.
Right.
Now, depending on the style of beer and what flavour we're trying to achieve, some of them have more American and New World hops, and some of them have more Kentish hops. So for example, our Kentish Reserve traditional bitter, premium bitter, that is mostly English because we're going for kind of a rich, fruity, you know, not too hoppy, just a hint with a kind of a mainly malty flavour. And then, for example, our East India Pale Ale, where we're going for kind of those zingy pine and citrus flavours, that's much more American-led.
Right.
We do tend to bitter the beer because you add the bitterness to the beer and the flavour in 2 separate stages.
Mm. Okay.
That tends to use an English hop for that because we find they have a really nice kind of smoothness to them.
Right, okay.
I love the way you talk about beer. Like,
he's very passionate, isn't he?
Somebody into wine would talk about wine. I don't think we think about beer in that same way. And you know, you're talking about the different flavors from different countries.
Oh, indeed. I mean, exactly the same. It's a bit more, you know, I think generally it doesn't tend to be too regional. It tends to be the hop growing areas within a country are mostly the same as with each other. Mm-hmm. So we're not quite up to the level of terroir, but I think the thing about wine is maybe it's gone a bit too far the other way, but I think beer was too long regarded as something you just chuck down your throat. And I don't want to make it where it's all tiny glasses and super expensive beer that's been aged for 20 years. You know, I still think having a couple of pints down the pub is the optimal place to drink it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, it's better to care about it. And I think there are a lot of, especially pubs, often not their fault, it's corporate management that's imposed this, that just chuck out whatever. And I think perhaps if consumers were a little bit more discerning and just had a quiet word with the publican, because you needn't buy very, very expensive or very, very niche beer to get a decent pint. Mm-hmm. I mean, loath as I am to say it, there are some big regional brewers making some good stuff. But then again, I mean, we can deliver to any pub anywhere in Kent once a week and anywhere in London twice a month. So for a lot, you know, huge swathe of the population, our beer could be in your pub,
you know,
as long as that pub is able to buy beer on the open market. So,
yeah.
Paul, am I allowed to try some yet?
Oh, go on then. Okay, oh, go
Tim,
on then.
Tim, can you choose one for me, please?
A couple of different ones and a couple of glasses. I think probably. If you're only going to have one, I would say try the flagship beer, which is our East India Pale Ale. It's...
Now, this label to me, because I've lived in Kent a long time, I just know it. If I just saw
it's a funky label as well, isn't it? Yeah,
I love the colours of it on it. It's lovely.
Well, it's actually based on a really large mural that's painted inside the Hotel Continental, which is one of the Oyster Company's properties.
Right.
So it was done by a local artist.
Tankerton. Beach Road.
Up the Tankerton end of Winstable.
Yeah, Beach Road, I know.
Yeah, near the Beacon House. And it's... it was painted originally by a local artist. So we simply asked his permission, could we have that, but to put on our beer labels? Some of them, for example, the Kentish Reserve, we've used sort of pictures of traditional Whitstable sort of stuff, you know, oyster smacks and that sort of thing.
Thank you.
But yeah, this one, you know, we had to keep that on there because, you know, it's obviously the core brand. So what we did with East India Pale Ale was we liked a lot of this kind of new world inspired beers that were coming over here, you know, with American hops, but some of them are a bit kind of overpacked. There's so much hop that it kind of it becomes a bit one dimensional, right. And often it kind of numbs the mouth a bit. So if you were to think of it in
after 4 pints, yeah.
if you think of it in like curry terms, for example, those would be more of a kind of a Madras or a Vindaloo, and lots of people like a Madras or a Vindaloo, and, you know, it can be done very well. But we wanted to go for perhaps a more sort of mid to high level of hoppiness. So it's hoppy enough that if you like a hoppy beer, you'll like this one. But a traditional bitter drinker would still try that and think, oh, that's a lovely beer. I mean, even perhaps for them, maybe more of a summer beer. But
I love the colour.
Something for everyone.
So what we've,
sorry, Tim, he's just taken a slug and I was going to ask him a question. So, Tim, this is your bestseller, your India Pale Ale. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a more modern interpretation of the India Pale Ale. I would one day love to brew a sort of a very, very strong, very, very hoppy beer as it would have been done in the 1800s to go to India.
Right.
But this, we want to get that kind of idea of hoppiness coming through the beer, but a bit of a lighter colour and obviously a much more accessible ABV. I mean, 4.1, it's, you know, slap bang in the middle. It's not what you'd call a session beer, but it's not ranging towards the premium end either.
A session beer. I haven't had one of those for a while.
Our second bestseller is our Native Bitter, which is a bronze-coloured 3.7% session beer. And, you know, that really is something that, you could have, even if you were driving, you could have at least a pint, if not maybe a pint and a half, depending on how sort of big you are. Mm. But it's no compromise on the flavour. It's a full-flavoured beer that just doesn't happen to be particularly strong.
And what hits me about this is the fragrance. Even before, you know, it was a foot away from me and I could smell... you know, it's just absolutely intoxicating. It just, it smells like it should. Yeah, yeah.
Literally.
But the smell of it is, it smells real, you know, smells just like, it just brings back a lot of memories, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you like it. I mean, bottling is actually, what people know this, but it's actually a lot harder than brewing. So trying to kind of get that crux between stability in the bottle so that it stays clear, shelf life, getting the carbonation right, all that sort of thing, while still maintaining the flavour is honestly one of the reasons I'm really grateful that our head brewer has so much experience because it can be very difficult and it's very easy to get it wrong.
Yeah.
I mean,
especially the carbonation, Tim, because that makes it, I mean, I was going to say for women, but a lot of women drink beer as men do. Mm. And actually, I think the carbonation can put a lot of people off. Mm. And this is just very... It's kind of refined, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a bottle conditioned beer, so it is an artificial carbonation, but we were very discerning with how strong we wanted. We didn't want it to be too fizzy, because especially when it's come out of the fridge, you know, obviously it can also kind of burn the back of the throat, and we didn't want to do that. And I think we've maintained almost all the flavour. I think the draft version of this that you'd have on a hand pump in a pub is going to be just that little bit more punchy and a little bit kind of smoother, and the conditioning will be even more kind of refined. But I think we've made a really good go of this, and, you know, it's lots of independent shops are selling crates and crates and crates of this because I think people appreciate taking it home.
Mm. Absolutely.
No, it's lovely. Mm. I really do like that one.
Just quickly, because we haven't got a huge amount of time. India Pale Ale, do you have any idea on the etymology of India Pale Ale?
There is a whole can of worms there. There is a guy who writes an entire blog on misconceptions about beer. So I kind of trot what's the popularly accepted line. But the idea was it was a beer that was strong and hoppy enough to last on a ship, sailing ship from Britain to India.
Right, okay.
And that was the
idea. Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Go with that. Cool. So what else have you got there, Tim?
Well, what I've brought here as well, I've got our Kentish Reserve Premium, which is our sort of a strong reddish amber bitter.
Right.
Lovely fruity flavour to that. That goes quite well with your sort of more traditional English cuisine. Roast beef, some kind of game. Because with all the bottles, I always make sure that we've alerted people to the possibilities of food pairing. So I brought that there.
Brilliant.
I also brought our Whitstable Pilsner, which is a Czech-style Pilsner with continental yeast, but brewed with English English bitterness and a Czech flavour hop. Right. So it's a nice kind of hybrid between the continental and the British beer world. That's one of our most popular keg beers. That obviously you'd go for a much more kind of delicate food to pair with that because you don't want to overpower it.
And that's a lager.
The lager here. Yep. Yes.
Okay.
And then I also brought some of our slightly more esoteric ones. So I brought our Oyster Stout, right, which obviously is a beer to go with oysters rather than containing oysters, but that goes well with any rich tasting food and also quite well with pudding because the roast malt in it gives sort of hints of chocolate and coffee. So it's a nice kind of thick, rich.
So that's
beer.
A stout?
Yes, that is a stout.
So can you tell us what it is that makes a beer a stout?
Basically, it is the idea behind a stout should be dark. So a very dark brown or darker. Ideally, compared to a mild, it should be stronger and it would have more hops in it than a mild.
Right.
Now, it is possible there are some people who make a very strong mild or a very weak stout, but that's the sort of general idea. So the idea is the roast malt flavour, a reasonable level of alcohol and, you know, a reasonable level of hoppiness to it.
Right.
But, I wish you brought some oysters to go with that. I should have.
Yeah, absolutely. We missed out there, didn't we?
And the last two I brought, which one of them is our Bavarian style wheat beer. So we've not really put much of a twist on that. We've just literally used wheat malt, from English wheat malt, but German wheat beer yeast and brewed your sort of traditional Hefeweizen style cloudy wheat beer. Lovely kind of hints of banana and clove to that one. You know, it's becoming more and more seen around in pubs and in, you know, bottle shops and so on, but we try to just make a really good interpretation on the style. And the last one is our most unusual beer, and it's kind of a favorite of mine, which is our raspberry wheat beer. So we brew more or less the same recipe as the wheat beer, but we don't allow that kind of banana and clove flavor to develop as much, and instead we add a huge amount of raspberries to it.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah,
hundreds of kilos. Actual
raspberries.
What we use, it's essentially, it's not artificial flavour. It's from real raspberry flavour, but, you know, obviously it's been strained and so on. But it's the equivalent of putting in a couple of 100 kilos of fresh raspberries were we to do that. Right. It's a lot easier for, you know, just fishing it in.
I might have to take that one home with me, Tim.
Well, we don't want to say it's the girl beer. Women do find it very popular, but it will go with lots of stuff. It goes very, very well with pudding. Mm. And when hot weather, it's absolutely perfect because it's not sweet, it's not a cloying beer, it's like a crisp tart raspberry, almost like a liquid sorbet.
Right.
So on the beach in Whitstable, I always make sure to have a pint of it.
He's good.
That's why he is head of sales.
Absolutely, he's good. He's really good. So what was the motivation for actually making the raspberry beer?
Well, because it was, I mean, I think originally it was, we wanted a beer that you know, that women wouldn't be embarrassed to drink. And it has, even since I started working 3 years ago, the number of women that drink beer regularly has gone massively. I mean, I met some friends I'd known at university last year. And back then it was all rosé or perhaps maybe a scrumpy. I was in the West Country, but... Yeah. We went to the pub and I was like, what does everyone want? And every single girl that I'd known in the intervening couple of years all wanted a pint of ale.
Right.
But back then we thought, you know, let's move this in there. And if they'll try a raspberry and they'll like that, maybe they'll try one of the other beers.
Yeah.
And we've kept brewing it because it's still popular. But it's no longer, you know, just the kind of entry level beer. There are plenty of women who now come in and order the East India straight away and they, you know, or even the stout.
I mean, I didn't realise that alcohol consumption has been on a steady decline for years, and it just keeps going down. But the only sort of segment of the market that's increasing is real ale and beers. Yeah. That's the only one where people are actually increasing.
Well, I don't want to sound doom and gloomist. I think often perhaps the people who aren't drinking enough, as in people who actually might, you know, who don't think there isn't a beer out there for them, and perhaps actually might enjoy having, going to the pub a little more often, perhaps are. And I think a huge amount of the alcohol that's consumed in this country is consumed by people who unfortunately do have a problem. And I think we are reducing that. So I think maybe it's the people, you know, the people who need to be cutting down are.
Yeah.
And it's people who might actually, you know, have enjoyed having a beer and didn't really feel there was one there for them that are increasing. So it's, I think it's much better if as a population, we drank less but better.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't think anyone
absolutely, yeah. And also, of course, there's a whole heap of other things going on here as well, because you've got drink driving laws.
Sure.
You've got whatever it is, 26 pubs a day closing in the UK. So, you know, there's all kinds of different things. And then you've got people that drink at home, you know, cans of... Yeah. Really cheap lager, 5p a can and all that kind of stuff. So I agree with Tim totally. It's about quality, and that's really where we've got to come back. And that's why talking to someone like Tim is so interesting.
It is.
Because he is so passionate, enthusiastic and knowledgeable about what he's doing. And it brings the beer alive. It brings it alive for you so that you can start to think about it in a different way.
Absolutely, yeah.
But even lager, for example, which... it's often even
lager.
Even lager. There are a lot of kind of beery people who are very, very against it. And I think it's quite sad because it is a wonderful style. But because it is somewhat easier to mass produce, that's why it became the go-to for the mega corporations pumping out not very good beer. But when it's done well, it's done, you know, it's brilliant. Mm. And I think, I mean, more and more English people are doing it. And I think it would be nice, you know, if in general terms, if pubs wanted to serve a really good lager, that they could find it from a UK supplier rather than having to import it.
Absolutely. So a lovely range of beers there from the Whitstable Brewery in Grafton Green. I'm on a roll with that.
Soon to be in Whitstable, 2 years from now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm being horrid to you for no good reason other than I know Grafton Green really well. Fantastic stuff that you're doing. At the moment, how do you supply your beer? Is it mostly through pubs, or are you supplying more and more to supermarkets and other outlets?
It is mostly direct to pubs, because all the casks, you know, the best place to taste a real ale style beer is out of a cask. So it's mostly to pubs. And, you know, we are seeing quite a few more ones opening that are more kind of quality beer focused, which is great. But we are always looking to expand our bottle offering, because we know not everyone can get down the pub every week. Not everyone lives in an area where there are any good pubs, sadly. So we're always looking to increase the bottle offering. At the moment, it is mainly bottles going to restaurants and independent places. But, you know, we're on the lookout to try and find a sort of a bigger channel. If we can work out somewhere that's going to be selling the beer in a way that, you know, is communicating our values to the customers.
Cool. Fantastic. We do love what you're doing, and we loved your enthusiasm for the beer that you've got there, Tim. So thank you so much for that.
There's just two little things I can get in. If everyone keeps their eyes peeled, in the next couple of months, we're going to be opening our first wet lead pub in Faversham on Preston Street. So that will be opening in the next couple of months. We'll make sure everyone knows in the local press. And the second thing is that if you ever do want to try some Whitstable beer at home, we do beer casks and kegs and bottles for parties and things, including setup. Just look up the brewery website, www.whitstablebrewery.co.uk. Give us a call, give us an email, and we can sort out all your sort of party and event needs.
Fantastic. Sounds brilliant. Yeah. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and understand a bit more about the beer and the lagers that you're brewing. And all power to you. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Paul, our time together, it's nearly over.
It is. I've got a busy week as well.
I've
got a little bit of a coup at the end of this week. Now, I mentioned this earlier to you and you just looked at me blankly because you're not of that age, are you? But on Channel Radio later this week, we have a first. We have a lady called Julie Felix. And those of us of a certain age will remember Julie from the 60s. She's a folk and rock musician and a very, very big musician in the 60s. Some of her songs are Flowers, The World Goes Round and Round, Going to the Zoo. You might have sung some of these songs to your kids, actually. Colours in the Rain.
Oh, yes, I know that one.
They're all Julie Felix songs. Julie's coming into our studio to join us to release her new album.
Wow.
So she's going to be playing live 3 o'clock this Saturday. So we're looking forward to that. Lots of work to do for that. But, hey, what a fabulous show again.
Really good. Yeah. Really enjoyed it. Yeah. Thanks again.
And we heard from the lovely folks at Kitchen Orchard and their gourmet-produced food.
Mm-hmm.
We heard some stuff about insects.
Yucky.
And we met the wonderful Tim with his range of fabulous beers and lagers. So, really, we're kind of at the end of another show.
Yeah.
the gang are all out there busily unboxing. Yep. So do have a look at the Facebook page.
Yes, Facebook today. It's on the Facebook Live. Yeah. They're on and off all day. The next session starts at 5:30. So do tune in to watch people unboxing all sorts of gadgets and things from in food tech.
Yeah, and there's also loads of stuff on the website.
Yeah.
There's recipes, there's podcasts, there's downloads of old shows. There's all kinds of stuff on there. So do have a look. Give us a shout for the website address.
www.foodtalk.co.uk.
It's foodtalk.co.uk. Do check it out. There's loads of resources on there. Have a look. But sadly, that's it for another week on the Food Talk Show with me, Paul Andrews, and the absolutely lovely Bradley Loss. Brady Loss.
Brady.
Where did that come from? Brady. Brady Loss. So thank you for joining us on the show. We'll be back with you next week and we'll talk to you all then. Cheers now.
Bye.